I'm Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer, and this is this week's Food for Thought. Our special guest this week is Chef Mike Gassaway. He's with the Culinary Department at Western Iowa Tech Community College. Chef Mike, thanks for joining us.
It is my pleasure to be here.
Are you ready for Easter?
I am getting so close to Easter. It's kind of a big part of our family. And, you know, it's a little bit, we're starting to create some traditions within our program as well. So it's an exciting time for us.
Of course it is. And you're here to kind of give us the history of the food behind Easter. Why don't we start with the egg? Because that came first, right?
It came first. There was no chicken. There was just eggs.
Just the egg.
So a couple different pieces that we could go from. Pulling back to like a Jewish Passover, and we can hit that in just a bit. And the other one is coming from sort of when Christianity was still pretty young, and they're trying to actively recruit. They're going side by side with some of the, you know, sort of the pagan traditions that had already been created. And so the pagan goddess of fertility, you know, she used egg as the symbol of spring, rebirth, that kind of deal. So they tied that in, and you know, they used it as Christianity used it as like the representative of the stone being, you know, removed from the tomb of Christ. So you move that stone back, and then cracking the whole resurrection, whatever. That's how they interpret it. It's a lot of stuff for an egg.
Yeah, it is. There's a lot more meaning than just, hey, look at what the Easter Bunny left us today, right?
No doubt. It is. It's interesting that the origins of the Easter egg itself came from where you they used to use. Eggs as a tithing for the church, and then to pay like the sharecropping and what have you from the peasantry, they would pay their landlords with these eggs, and they would decorate them, you know, to make them more appealing. They used the color red was very important from, you know, symbolistic with, you know, blood of Christ and all that stuff. They became such a hit that the nobility started giving them as gifts, and then they made them, you know, they would like commission them and have, you know, beautiful paintings done on these little eggs and have them gilded with like gold and silver and that kind of stuff, which is what we know now as like the Fabergé eggs. That's how that tied in.
Oh yeah, that'd be nice to have a couple dozen of those, right?
No doubt. Apparently, early Christianity was super hardline on Lent, and so you couldn't for fasting, you couldn't eat a lot of the proteins that, you know, people were used to using. So eggs were that piece that you could consume, and so it was really almost a more important commodity than the rest of the year. So they made it more and more ostentatious as you went along.
You know, what's your favorite way to make an egg? We're going to go off topic real quick.
There it goes. That's what we do. We don't stay on task. Family tradition. Everybody has a different name for this, but you take a piece of bread, pull out the center, put it in a saute pan, add a little butter down and whatever, and then you crack an egg in the middle of it, you know, in season. We call it, I don't know why, I have no idea why, but we call it a winky at our house.
A winky, or a
toad in the hole.
Toad in the hole before.
Yeah, man, it seems like everybody's got a different name for it.
But that's favorite way to make an egg.
Oh, for sure. Right now, you know, things change. You know, everything kind of holds interest in me for a little while, and then I try something different and whatever. Right now, Winkies are where it's at.
Winkies, all right. That's great.
Man.
Now, going back to the history of it, the egg had so much symbolism. Today, of course, it spreads joy to little kids when they see these eggs all over the place. It's just amazing how a lot of things came from old tradition.
It does.
And it's been modified to the modern age, right?
Oh, man. You know what's fun is, so the Easter egg hunt. you know, I went going to look for that. What they did, that was a nobility thing as well. They're trying to entertain their kids just like anybody else, right? And so they would take these eggs and they would hide them in the bushes and the kids would go find them. And then it became something that the adults did as well. Like, I mean, you think about those fox hunts or hunting for deer or whatever. That's where that started, was these elaborate Easter egg hunts on these huge grounds for the nobility. And it just kind of got passed through. If we think about those egg rolls at
the White House. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's all that started, you know, several hundred years ago. It's all kind of cool stuff to me. I kind of geek out on that stuff.
Oh, you do. Well, that's why you're here. You're kind of like the expert about food and a little bit of the history too.
By expert, you mean I talk a lot? Yeah, we're good. So, what else do you want to know about as far as Easter? What else can
we? Well, we talked about the egg, but what are some other kind of foods that kind of are tied in with Passover and as well as the Easter holiday?
Sure. Well, what I learned was that a lot of, you know, obviously, you know, Judaism, you know, being that, you know, that foundation for Christianity, a lot of the Easter traditions are based on Passover. And so Passover being the exodus of the Jews from, you know, from Egypt, from, you know, getting away from the Pharaoh. And so there's so much symbolism that goes along with it. So talking to some friends that are pretty active in the synagogue here, and kind of got the history behind some of the things that we're familiar with, like the Seder meal is representative of the whole Passover. And it's usually done on the first night. And it's interesting that it's not really done in the temple. It's done at home with families, which is different than a lot of the Jewish traditions. And so they have all these representative pieces of that time, like lamb being that symbolic sacrifice to God, but you don't want to waste anything, you know, so why not let it be tasty as well? We could look at bitter herbs. They talk about horseradish being bitterness for the bitterness and the anguish that they felt in the enslavement. And then they talk about dipping vegetables into salt water, sometimes with some, you know, fresh parsley, and parsley becoming part of that integral part of Easter, you know, the renewal, even in the face of dipping the salty tears, right? They're still talking about the possibility of renewal. There's another piece that has to do with apples and nuts, and sometimes, from what I understand from my buddy, cinnamon that's involved, that talks about the bricks that the Jews had to, they had to hand make to make all of these buildings for the Egyptians, and the mortar, and they talk about those being representative of the brick and the mortar, and so they've turned that into something that is sweet, you know, from something that was so tragic for them. So a lot of really cool stuff. You can't have anything without, and this is where it ties back into Christianity. The unleavened bread, they talk about matzah. My buddy explained to me, it was kind of a neat story. I hadn't heard it explained like this. They take the dough from the bread, but they had to run. So they put it on their backs, and the heat of the desert cooked the bread. It wasn't allowed time to leaven. And so you have this flat bread. And they would eat it, and it obviously got crunchy and what have you. You eat it sort of like a cracker. And if you think about, you know, for folks that, you know, Christians going to around the Easter time, they go to church and they're taking communion. They've got the little wine or the grape juice, you know, for blood of Christ, but the body of Christ is always that really awful crackery thing that they put on your tongue, and that's what is that? But, you know, unleavened bread. So all those pieces tying back into each other. I love that. I love the way history contorts and it pulls back together. But these are the things that we bring back to our history.
looking ahead, okay, for Easter Sunday, what is on your menu?
What's on the menu?
Yeah, at your home for Easter Sunday.
Big Macs.
You're going to make it easy.
I think that we always have to have asparagus. That's kind of a passionate thing that it's amazing that an entire group of people, no matter how close they are, are so disparate, but they all agree that asparagus is good. So we'll do that, and we'll probably do some ham. That has been a tradition on both sides of the family for a while, and there's some fun history. So I'll bore the kids with that for a bit. You know, we're in Iowa, so I'm afraid cheesy hash browns might actually show up.
The cheesy hash browns.
That's the way it goes. It's the full Iowa. You know, you never go full Iowa. That's what that is.
So. And where are you from originally?
Originally from Southwest Missouri. So
okay.
Ozarks, Hillbillies, Summer Teeth, Moonshine.
Because I was going to say, you were kind of making fun of Iowans there, and then never
yes.
mind.
Yep. No, we can just, you know, I can equally bash.
Okay.
Depending on where that goes.
Now, for when you do asparagus, that's kind of an acquired taste. You either enjoy asparagus or you don't.
Right.
What would be the best way to make asparagus, maybe, so everyone would enjoy it?
Man. Okay, so this is what happens. You know, when somebody asks me, they try to give me an ultimatum, what's the best way to do things? A lot of times I refer back to something my wife did, because in some ways she's just a better cook than I am. And she always falls back on, simple roasting with some butter, olive oil, and some salt and pepper and lemon. I mean, it's so integral.
Lemon.
You gotta have lemon with asparagus. It just brings out all the natural flavors that asparagus has to offer. And it just sprinkle a little bit,
or how much do you squirt on that?
Yeah, it kind of depends on how much you're doing. I like to say maybe half a lemon per bundle. You know, that's usually how they come. And you don't want to just soak it, and just burn it up with acid. But a good squeeze from those things, or you got that weird little lemony looking plastic thing in your fridge, because I know some folks do. A teaspoon of that concentrate stuff would do just about the same thing. So. That would work.
And storing asparagus is something I learned. You can store it in water in your fridge, just like you would a flower.
Yes.
And it'll last forever. Because I bought a bunch on sale, and you can kind of even nip the ends off, mm-hmm. and they just sit there.
Yes.
It looks weird in your fridge, and you have to be a little careful. You don't, like, just dump it over. But I don't know if that's what you do, but someone told me that one time, and it tends to work.
It never lasts that long in our house,
because you're eating it right away.
But absolutely, that's a huge way. It's interesting you say that. It's just like flowers. You want to remove that bottom real stalky fibrous piece anyway, mm-hmm. but that's what you do with flowers when you snip off the bottom, and then usually start them with a little bit of hot water, and then they cool off in the fridge, and it's great. That really holds on to them for a long time. That's what they want. So, I think that hits asparagus. I mean, you can boil or bake or pan fry or whatever. Asparagus is good.
Yeah, it's hard to really mess it up unless you really burn it, right?
Absolutely.
And even then, maybe you could still eat it.
Yeah, we just won't tell anybody.
Or give it to the dog.
Give it to the dog.
No, that's not good. I know. Well, it has been really interesting talking about the history of Easter, because like you said, a lot of the things in the past come full circle, literally with an egg, obviously.
Absolutely. My students get a little tired of me sometimes talking about history and traditions, but we're losing those. And so, I mean, anything that we can do to remind ourselves of where, our culture and our food came from. That's key. That's the ticket to our future. I was trying to pull something cliche there, but it really is. We have to know our past. So,
well, it sounds like you know what you're doing. That's great. The culinary department. Tell us a little bit about that. How many students and what kind of things do they learn?
Okay, so ostensibly a 2-year program, and you're learning and you're getting credentials as you go through. So that's kind of a fun deal. You know, you go through the first semester and you've taken a couple of national board certified tests. And you're already kind of advancing your knowledge of some things. We're going to make sure that you at the start have knife skills, one of your first classes, you know, so that you can properly execute what you're going to do for the next year and a half. You'll take the National Restaurants Association's ServSafe program, so that so you don't kill anybody. That's probably a pretty good idea. So hopefully that keeps us on the straight and narrow. And then we do a lot of fun things. We do meat fabrication. We do menu planning and analysis. We do international and American regional cuisine. They get a lot crammed into 2 years. And sometimes all of the groups are for the most part cohorts. So the group that you start with is the group that you finish with. And they're just, we just kind of refer to them as the families. Right now we're in the family of 2019. So they take in a lot. Sometimes I feel like it's too much. But at the same time, you know, there's so much more that we could show them. We try to follow basics and give them a good foundation so they can go out and they can kind of specialize as they want.
Could you teach anyone to be a good chef?
I can.
Or do you have to kind of? Why don't I'll let you answer.
I could teach just about anyone to cook. My wife's best friend Jill, literally can burn water. It's astounding. So I can't help her. I can't. And I struggle with it, but I can't help her. But everybody, for the most part, we have people that have a tremendous base of knowledge already, and we're accentuating that, and that's great. And then we have folks that are coming in. You know, we have people that have never cooked in restaurants in their life. We have people that are 17 to 64, I think, that have come in. So what a wide variety of ages and cultures and sex and race and blah, blah, blah. It's, you know, we have a whole, we've got the diaspora of life in our program. No one's cookie cutter.
Any quick advice for people listening on maybe what they could do to improve their skills?
Read and read. And realize that it's not a daunting task. Anyone can cook. Anyone that has even just a little bit of passion to learn and to make something is gonna do well. You can't be intimidated by the end result. You just, you know, how do you eat the elephant? You know, one bite at a time. So relax, calm, take some deep breaths, get a shot of whiskey if you need, whatever. You know, and then it's not as daunting as you think it is.
The big thing is having the passion and desire.
Absolutely. I'm just like anybody else. I struggle to, oh my gosh, what are we going to serve tonight? You know, what am I going to cook for the kids and that kind of thing? We all have those moments. But I think, you know, once you get into it, once you start the process, you know, even the most monotonous meal in the world can be kind of fun if you let it be.
Well, especially if you have a good conversation at the dinner table, too.
Yes. Man, that's important. You know, I know we've all had experiences where you just want to, you know, gnaw your arm off to get out the from the table. But if you have some good conversation, the food's better.
All right. Well, Chef Mike, thank you so much for stopping by, giving us some food for thought and even more, I think, today.
It's been a pleasure. I'm a big fanboy of yours. So this is like a dream come true.
Oh boy. Except I think you said Jim Scott had more skills.
You know, he's my hero. So, but you run a close second.
All right. Well, thank you. No, Jim Scott, of course, does small wonders, and you've been a wonder as well. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure meeting you.
Happy Easter to you and your family.
Happy Easter to you.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Food for Thought.